Blog Talk Radio.
Transformed. This program is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. We're not here so much to tell you about the future as we are to encourage you to think about your future and to consider what may be the biggest transformation of them all, the one that will occur in your life, in your world, the one that begins with recognizing and acting on the vast possibilities that are unfolding before you and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does that amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I am doing great. Looking forward to the Christmas coming up here in 1 week's time, and get into the spirit with the family a little bit, you know, so. Yeah, it's an excellent time of the year, particularly for families that have small children. It's just fun, you know.
It is so much fun and so exhausting at the same time.
But, yes, it's all of that rolled into one burrito of stress and fun and all of that mixed
and
in together.
Spending,
yeah.
Let's not forget.
But and expense. Yes, throw that in there
it's
too.
It's a tremendous time. We've actually got the in-laws in town. My wife's parents are visiting from Malaysia, so we're having loads of fun.
That is a big deal. That's a long way to come.
Long trip.
Yeah.
But neat. Once the grandchildren showed up, they're finding their way up here, you know. And, of course, we got to get back down there eventually. But, man, that's a long trip even without three little kids. You know what I'm saying?
Right. What is it, a 20-hour plane ride and probably making
Yeah, when you count all the carryovers, yeah, when you go from door to door and add it up on the most efficient flight you can get, it's going to be something like 26, 27 hours total travel time. So
it's the opposite side of the world. Yeah.
Yeah. It's about as far as you can go. I mean, you're coming back if you go any further.
It's so far you don't have jet lag because it's not that far. But, you know, it's like the opposite side of the world. You know,
it's almost like you don't have jet lag. You're just more comatose than anything else. You're just done. But anyway, enough about that. This is our first show in December. Is that right? Can that possibly be right? We haven't had a show in December. I've missed a couple of weeks, and we're not going to have a show next week because we're just closing down for the holidays. So this will be our only show for December of 2013.
We have not done, been on that kind of schedule for doing, podcasting probably since, about 2006, 2007? Because, back in those days, we kind of did one whenever we felt like it, which might be once a month or whatever. But, once we started here with Blog Talk Radio and the service immediately preceding that, too, we got on the 1 week, once a week schedule, and we've stayed pretty consistent with that. So, Phil, you're feeling better, and so we're happy about that. So,
yeah, back in the world, back in the game, and hopefully we'll not encounter any more slowdowns like that. Unfortunately, it happened that I got sick on the day of the show, and then the following week I wasn't quite back. So cost us a couple of shows this month, but we're going to come roaring back in January. We'll talk about that a little bit when we talk about exciting things that will be happening in 2014, because our show tonight is all about the biggest developments that are moving us towards the future that have occurred in 2013, and what do they tell us about what's coming in 2014. So I thought it'd be fun to, just do some futurism this evening, right? So I called the show This Week in the Future. And we're really looking at how have we moved closer to the future in 2013. And, you know, as I started going down the list, there have been some fairly substantial things. It's a pretty eventful year, isn't it?
Yes, and in some surprising ways. And we're going to talk about some things that are not even, you know, I don't know what you would call, you know, futuristic in a way. It's just we got at least one article, one thing we're going to talk about that's really more about political intrigue than anything else. But it's
I think it speaks very strongly to the future, and we'll get into that.
Yeah.
Not necessarily technology, although there's a big technological component to that one. But we'll stop being coy and we'll just jump into these. My number one news story, and actually these aren't in any particular order in terms of impact. I think they sort of work backwards through time, like the most recent one to the least recent one, but I'm not sure if that even holds up. So in no particular order, but the one I listed as number one. The China lunar probe lands on moon with rover. You know, this, it seems to me, should be a much, much bigger news story than it is. China has had significant progress with their space program over the last few years. They've been sending taikonauts, into space, and they've been replicating some of the efforts that both the United States and the Soviet Union did in the 1960s with new technology, new ways of doing some of those same things. But they've been replicating that success, and now they've taken the next step. They've landed a probe on the moon. There's a rover on the moon. First, as has been pointed out, first soft landing on the moon in about 40 years, 40 plus, I'm thinking.
That fact is sad to me.
Well, isn't it?
I'm happy for the Chinese and what they've done in some ways, and in others I envy for my own country. But it's sad that mankind has not put anything on the moon, not even so much as a probe, you know, soft landed it in 40 years. That's amazing.
Now we have put a few things. We bang things into the moon to see what happens.
Yeah, exactly. We've exploded. Looked and see, okay, we just threw a refrigerator-sized object into this crater, and
right.
what comes out?
What kind of dust,
you know?
Comes up? Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
We've done that, and that was pretty cool. It was that particular test confirmed ice water on the moon, and that was pretty neat. But to me, it's a little bit sad that we haven't, you know, set something down gently on the moon in that period of time, but. Maybe we'll see some renewed interest in the moon. We need to. It's a huge, huge resource, and it's relatively close by comparison to other objects in the solar system. So it's reachable, and there's lots that can be done there.
It's just sitting right there. I mean,
yeah, it's right.
The,
I mean, look out your
one,
window.
One of the great things about being from Earth. In terms of moving into space, is we always had this huge target to aim at starting out. You know, just beautiful.
Exactly. It's right.
Not
there,
too
guys.
Far away, you know. I mean, kind of far, but not too far away. And it's got a lot of land. There's a lot you can potentially do there. And it's very interesting that this is a fairly big news story, but not it's not calamitous. You know, there's no panic going on in the U.S. the way there was when the Soviets launched Sputnik. And a lot of that, I guess, has got to do with the whole been there, done that. It's like, yeah, well, we already put people on the moon multiple times. We won the space race half a century ago, right? So there's nothing for us to feel threatened about, nothing for us to prove in this domain. That's ancient history, and we don't care. I presume is the basic motivation behind the kind of nonchalance with which the story is taken in the U.S. I don't know about the rest of the world. I don't know how the rest of the world is responding. Obviously, I'm only seeing this through the filter of U.S. media, but it seems to me that the response is muted at best, and it makes me wonder, well, what would it take to get people interested in the moon again if China lands people on the moon, right? Will that stir the pot? And I think this is stirring the pot elsewhere. Right, I think India is looking at this and going, "Hey, we've been talking about maybe going to the moon, right?" And and they might start getting interested. And I see that it is completely revamped interest in the Lunar X Prize, which has been going on for some time, and now suddenly is being pursued with greater urgency. And of course, that's an effort to get private groups to, I believe, land a probe, not a rover, not anything as sophisticated as what the Chinese are doing, but a probe, actually to shoot a probe to the moon.
Right.
Just by private individuals, which is another great example of one of the trends we talk about, which is the passing of capability from nation states into the hands of individual, one of the trends that's kind of shaping the future. So here we see China, one of the great economic powers of the world, they're going to the moon, and then we've got some individual groups that are also working on going to the moon, and India is probably showing some interest in going to the moon. Europe, are they interested? They don't seem to be. Russia lost interest in the moon after we got there first and has never shown any interest since. And the U.S., as far as I know, no plans to return to the moon.
Nothing on the short-term horizon anyway. But you know what? You were saying, what would it take to get us interested? Glenn Reynolds pointed something out that might get us interested in returning to the moon. The fact that this particular space probe soft-landed in what could be a very rich helium-3 area of the moon, right?
Right.
And so what could China then do? China could say, well, you know, we're there. This is our patch of helium-3, and we're going to start bringing it home. And,
for those
who
need catching up, helium-3 is a – what do you call that, an isotope of helium, of some variety of helium?
It is an isotope of helium. Yeah,
mineral form of helium.
That
go ahead.
Is potentially the best, not potentially, it is the best, even theoretically, they can't think of a better fuel for fusion reactors, which, of course, we don't have yet. We don't have a fusion reactor yet, but if we were able to build one, helium-3 would be the best fuel for it, and the moon is just loaded with it. Helium-3 is a very rare isotope on Earth, but for whatever reason, it's not on the moon. And if they start bringing this stuff home, it apparently, and I've heard numbers on it. It's like if we were able to, and of course we can't, but if we were able to land a space shuttle on the moon and fill it up with moon dust in a rich area. An area that's rich with helium-3, and bring that home. You know, one space shuttle full of the stuff would put it in refine it, get the helium-3 out of it, and put it in reactors. We could power the United States for a year.
Wow.
With
essentially a truckload, right? I mean, would be the,
yeah. It's more than a truckload. Space shuttle obviously is bigger than that, but it's with one trip to the moon with a large cargo plane basically, you could power the United States with the helium-3 that you could bring home. So yeah, that's a big deal. And what if China is able to produce that reactor first, and they're on the moon, and they're bringing home the helium-3, and we're not anywhere close to having that capability again.
And one of the things Glenn points out is that China, having landed something there, might do something that we never did upon landing on the moon, or have not done landing on Mars or Venus, either one. They might make a territorial claim.
I would imagine that our enemies probably, or at least those that were envious of the United States back in the 60s, probably didn't much care for the flag planting that we did. But we never really tried to make it official that this is U.S. soil, you know.
On the contrary, we left a plaque that said we came in peace for all mankind. Right? We never said we claimed it for the U.S., and we are signatories, as is China, on a treaty which says you can't claim territory in space. But one of the things Glenn points out is...
It wouldn't be the first time a nation just throws out a treaty and says, you know what...
Well, and in fact, you can withdraw from this treaty. You have to give a year's notice, but they can withdraw, and then a year later say, hey, that spot where we landed that probe, that's ours. What legal impact that will have, what legal bearing it will have, who's to say? But what psychological impact will it have when people say, hey, you know, the Chinese are claiming land on the moon now because there's resources up there that could potentially be extremely valuable. That might start to motivate people. If not the U.S., India's interest might get all the keener. And once someone breaks that treaty, which, by the way, it was interesting. Glenn Reynolds, obviously a very pro-American guy, but he thinks it'd be all to the good if China made a territorial claim up there, exactly because it would ignite this kind of fire, that it would probably get the space race going again.
Well, think of it this way. The New World got real when the European powers began claiming hunks of it, you know.
Right.
All of a sudden, the trickle of boats going across the Atlantic, with explorers became just there was a rush, and that led to the development of the New World, to the chagrin of those who were already there, of course. But
right.
You don't have that issue with the moon, Apollo 18 notwithstanding. We'd be going there and we would be bringing home the resources for all mankind. And so, yeah, maybe we need a space race based on economics this time. I think that's the right model.
If anything is going to get people interested in it again, I think it'll be those kinds of things. It'll be the opportunity to exploit resources there, take advantage of resources, let's say leverage. That's not as negatively weighted a word as exploit.
Yeah.
Resources there we can use, right? Consume, make good use of. You start talking about competition. You start talking about real business opportunity, and then there's a reason to go to them. And why did we go the first time? Well, as we've talked about before, it was all about national status. It was all about who gets there first between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. But as we've discussed, it turns out it was probably just more or less another front of the Cold War, and probably our most peaceful front of the Cold War. But actually, we went to the moon, but what we were trying to do was defeat communism, right? The Russians were trying to go to the moon, and what they were trying to do was make communism win, right? So it was,
you know what's ironic about that is that it was – you weren't exactly proving that capitalism is the better system when it was a massive government project that got us there. Is our massive government project beat your massive government project, I guess. But
our massive government project did use private contractors, whereas theirs used government
agents.
There you go.
That's true. I shouldn't get too down on that. So
yeah,
absolutely.
So it is a difference. And we won, yay. But, although I've always wondered, what if they'd gotten there first? Maybe the race wouldn't have ended, We'd probably have cities and everything else.
We would have said, we're going to have a moon base by, 1980, and we would have done it. It would have been, something like, who knows.
Yeah,
we might have been on Mars.
It would have kept going. For as long as the Soviet Union was around, I think we would have still had, and they might have lasted longer if they'd have made it to the moon. Who knows? Interesting
alternate history there.
Alternate history, science fiction there. But anyway, I think this is a huge story and a very much underrated story in terms of the impact on the future, because I think it speaks to big changes. Obviously, it speaks to who the players in the world are in space right now. It's private groups and it's emerging powers in space. It's not the U.S. It's not Russia anymore. And it speaks to the possibility of nation states claiming territory in space, a whole new thing. Speaks to the possibility of seeking resources in space, all these kinds of trends we've been talking about. And we see a lot of these things starting to come into clearer focus with this story in 2013. So we'll see what happens in 2014. We'll see if China announces they found helium-3, if they announces that the part of the moon is now Chinese dirt, or the whole moon. That would be interesting if they were to claim the whole thing. And interesting times ahead, I think.
Absolutely. Okay.
All right.
But there's more.
Item two. We don't have to do all mine in order if you've got another one you want to do.
Well, let me go ahead then and jump into a couple of mine. Ken in the chat room asked an interesting question. He's saying, okay, so helium-3 is a big deal, but it looks like our ability to get hydrogen from water is going to get much cheaper, and solar is going to get much cheaper. Why even bother with the helium-3? Well, the difference is, helium-3 would be able to provide massive amounts of power in a very few number of power plants, and that's one model for energy in the future. Another model is solar, and my item is, I don't know if I'm actually answering your question or just using your question as a segue, Ken, but anyway, we may get around to answering your question. But what we're looking at with solar, it's about to get a lot more efficient. We got a Caltech, and I'm trying to get to my notes here, Phil. We have a Caltech professor who talked about I can't find it. But anyway, yeah, oh, here it is. Harry Atwater.
Yes.
Yeah. So he's at Caltech. He has the theoretical basis, but he's more than that. He's done some experimental, showing some prototypes. He's got three different models for how to improve solar panels. And it comes down to this, with all three of these models, it's based on basically the same thing. Break the light apart into its component colors, you know, like a prism, and then have semiconductors that are made specifically for each color. Instead of getting a semiconductor that just sort of is able to, you know, use all light, but very inefficiently, you can increase your efficiency more than double efficiency by breaking it apart and having semiconductors for each individual color of light. And so we're talking going from 20% efficiency on solar panels to 50% or better. And what we're talking about when you're, you know, just a few marginal changes in, you know, you could take efficiency up to maybe 30%, and you're talking about already crossing the what we call the solar singularity for most of the country. And what we mean by that is that when you reach grid parity with the amount of energy you're able to produce with solar panels, and in other words, if it's cheaper to put solar panels on your roof than it is to plug into to your local grid, then everyone's going to do it. And so solar's about to get a lot more a lot more attractive for people, and maybe we can, we can do it without the tax credits. You know, it can compete with the grid all on its own, and so that's exciting. That's very, very exciting.
I'd say one of the things that's really interesting about that is kind of like with Moore's Law, and Ray Kurzweil talks about solar as a technology developing very much along the same lines as information technology in terms of how rapidly we're seeing returns on our ability to produce solar energy. What Atwater is talking about is very much in line with the kind of progress we've seen in solar over the last few years anyway. So
right.
we've already had a 50% improvement, and kind of in the same way when people say, oh, Moore's Law is about to run out, and then somebody says, no, but we can actually, we can build chips this way, and it's gonna give us this much more life.
We can do quad cores now, exactly. Like that. Yeah.
Suddenly there's another way we can do it, and Moore's Law just keeps plugging along. This kind of development is the same sort of thing. Just when we think, well, we must be leveling off with how well we can do with solar. Nope, another big development comes along, and suddenly we're able to do a lot more than we were. I think the solar singularity approaches, and it does so quietly. It's this huge, massive change in how the world works. It's going to be extremely impactful on the international scene, on how nations relate to each other, because energy is such a big piece of that puzzle anyway. And it's going to be huge. To answer Ken's question, we might decide we just want to go to the moon because it's fun to go to the moon if solar really pays off. On the other hand, the more energy you have, the more energy you need. So
exactly. We always find things to do with it. But I think, he points out an important thing here. We talk about grid parity based on the grid we've got today.
Right.
What if we've got a grid that's being powered by fusion reactors with helium from the moon? You know, I mean, so we're talking like for a tiny fraction of the expense of the electricity we have today, we've got electricity in the future because, you know, it's just practically free power. Okay, once you
go to the moon and get the stuff and figure out how to build a fusion plant. But you know, details.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you know, then grid parity becomes a lot harder to reach with solar panels, no matter how good you get at it. If you got practically free fusion power for the nation. So, I think it kind of comes down to it'll be kind of a race between the two. Solar is always if you need to produce power locally, you know, close to where you need it, solar is particularly useful. You know, if you have enough solar panels on your roof to produce a substantial portion of your family's power, and that's already, you know, then that may be great, you know, until you realize, you know what, I spent all this money and now we got fusion. And, you know, my electric bills for everybody else just dropped to like 10% of what they were before. Don't I feel stupid for having invested? But, you know, it's hard to say which direction
it
goes
down. Might be closer.
Fusion is one of these things that's – it's been 30 – you know, we've been perpetually within 20 to 30 years of having fusion for the last 60 years, you know. So who knows when that comes about.
It could be a ways off. It could happen exactly as you said that we've got solar providing abundant, inexpensive energy, and then suddenly fusion comes along, and it's like the new paradigm because it's so much cheaper, and then solar gets better, and it becomes the new thing. So there are lots of potential opportunities, but I don't want to miss the other one that Ken mentioned, which almost made my list because this is a really big story that researchers have split water into hydrogen and oxygen using light and nanoparticles. This is potentially very big. The ability to, we've got all this hydrogen we could be burning on the planet if it wasn't all tied up in water. And, of course, extracting it from water turns out to take about as much energy as you get. So it turns hydrogen less into a fuel
source.
More into a storage medium, right? It's not a particularly good one at that. You know, I mean, if you're not getting net energy out of it, why bother? But if there was some other way of getting oxygen and hydrogen in water to separate, to isolate that hydrogen, to burn the hydrogen, then hydrogen looks a lot more interesting. And now they're doing it. The reason actually they've been doing it this way for years and years, for 40 years at least, using different catalysts. There are certain catalysts you can put in, and it causes the reaction to happen. The problem is most of those catalysts are expensive the other way. It's like, well, now I got to go mine all this catalyst, and by the time I've done that, I might as well have burned petroleum rather than try to extract this hydrogen. Well, this is using nanoparticles of cobalt oxide, and cobalt oxide is not massively abundant, but it is something that could be produced probably in sufficient quantities that would enable something like this if it could be made more stable. This is the real problem with cobalt oxide right now, is it doesn't last very long. It's got a really short shelf life, and then you got to get more of it. So right now, even though this looks very promising, they haven't actually escaped the cycle yet. It's still a lot more expensive to get the hydrogen out than the energy that you get from it. So it's very promising, and I'm looking forward to seeing what they do with this. But so far, it's not cheaper. It's not a breakthrough along the lines of what's been happening with solar. But we'll stay tuned to that because eventually something is probably gonna break there.
Well, we've the natural world has been doing this ever since the leaf was developed, you know, and as part of photosynthesis, water is split into its components of hydrogen and oxygen. And the more they understand about it, it appears that plants are taking advantage of quantum processes. It's that complex. And the more they understand what's going on there, the more they admire it and want to develop the artificial leaf. And so that's let's keep an eye on that because that's potentially huge as well.
Eventually, the energy future becomes a lot bigger or I should say is completely different from the world we live in. That's for sure. And what's going to shake out and what's actually going to be the driver of that or how these different things are going to mix together, we just don't know yet. But we'll look for, in 2014, more indications one way or the other. I think we'll see a lot more progress with solar. I think we'll see increasing interest in things like fusion, and I think we'll see a lot of interest in getting that hydrogen out of water, because it's a great deal once you have it. I mean, hydrogen is a clean burn. You know, it's most abundant element in the universe. After all, it's got a lot going for it. Okay. So let's move on. We're halfway through the show, and we've only covered two of these. We got other big ones.
Well, I want to quickly jump into my next one because it works hand in glove.
Okay, go. Dovetail.
Stuff we've already talked about. Okay, back about 100 years ago, there was a big conflict between two really smart guys regarding how we're going to get our electricity, right? Edison was the, if I remember correctly, he's the DC guy, right? And it was Nikola Tesla who was the AC guy. And although Tesla died penniless and alone, his vision won out, and we have power grids now with alternating current. And there's a number of reasons for that, and one of the biggest ones is that it turns out it's just very, very difficult to have DC, a power grid based on DC. Sending direct current electricity over long distances. What Edison had in mind was literally a little power plant like every block, you know, inside of a city, and that's just not the way we ended up going. We went AC and having power, a large power plant, miles away from the city, powering the city. So that's the vision that won out. Well, turns out that DC may not be as, there may be some good things about DC, and there's some developments in Europe, in Sweden, I believe, where they say, well, you know what, perhaps we can do DC grids, because what they have developed is a high voltage DC circuit breaker that would allow the building of these power grids, and powered by direct current. And direct current would be more efficient at connecting, things. You know, once you're able to have a grid, and this is the enabling technology for that, you can connect the sources of your power can actually be further away than AC. So you could have the Sierra Desert, solar in the Sierra Desert powering Europe, things like that. You could connect things much further away than before.
Pumping energy directly from say Africa to Europe.
Exactly. And if you couple that with what we were already talking about with solar getting, twice as efficient with some developments from Caltech, all of a sudden you've got something. You're able to power Europe. That's the way you go about it. Or, you power the United States with power, that we get primarily from the Southwest, things like that. So, that's exciting.
A really interesting model. For those who root for Edison and the Edison versus Tesla debate, which Edison doesn't get a lot of good press anymore. It seems like Tesla's kind of won out in the hearts and minds.
Tesla's kind of a rock star rebel kind of thing, where Edison always represented the establishment, So
he's the man, exactly.
Yeah.
So, for him to suddenly win out would be a big shock. But what's interesting about this one, Stephen, is this could happen, and talk about a thing nobody would even notice, right? It's like because I assume the local grid would remain AC, right? We wouldn't change anything we're doing with our current appliances and all that kind of stuff. This would be like the trunk lines that are feeding power between cities and that sort of thing, right? We're not going to suddenly switch over to being a direct current world.
Well, I mean, it would. We've got a lot of built-in infrastructure, even within our homes. We've got AC appliances,
Right.
And it's possible to buy DC appliances. I mean, if you have a solar panels on your roof and you want to power your home with DC, you can take that step. It's pretty expensive, I understand, because, you know, they don't make a lot of DC appliances, but you can get them, and you can do that. And so it's doable, but I would imagine that it would take a lot to make that conversion. You know, we have not shown a willingness often to let go of legacy. We don't have the metric system yet in the United States, for one thing.
So, yeah, for example. And that's really just because we don't want to have to deal with the math, whereas this would be everything you own that has a cord on it, you'd have to change, right? That would be
exactly. And, you know, we still have QWERTY keyboards when they're demonstrably not as good as Dvorak. We all know how to type with QWERTY keyboards, and I'm not going to give that up. I can fly with a QWERTY keyboard, even though we know it's not the most efficient layout. You know.
Right. So. Right. So it seems to me there have to be some conversion in there somewhere before it actually occurs, or it would have to be so good that everybody's like, okay, that's fine, we'll just switch over.
But yeah, it's
it would have to be really.
You know, it's people who make the conversion are rewarded with much lower bills or something. You know, so
yeah, something like that.
It would take something like that
for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, I've got a big one at the departure. We've been talking space, we've been talking energy, and now I want to talk about Mr. Snowden and the NSA scandal. A huge, huge story, and this is the one you were talking about, Stephen, that seems more political than technological. But it's very
geopolitical,
telling,
yes.
I think, of the world that we live in, right? That we have this characterize him as you will. Disgruntled employee, whistleblower, patriot, hero, traitor, whatever you want to call him. This one individual guy who gets a hold of, is this right, 1.7 million classified documents? And
I've heard it put this way, that he got it all. You know, I've heard, you know, but guys that are in the know say, yeah, he got all our secrets. He's got it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's an amazing amount of intelligence he was able to get. And the fact that one person was able to, and he wasn't even like, one of the, he wasn't the guy with top secret clearance necessarily. He was just, kind of a flunky, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And
he was a computer tech of some kind. Yeah, just one of the guys. But he had the access. And, yeah, so immediately, to me, this once again speaks to passing of tremendous capability from the hands, this time literally from the hands of a nation state to an individual, not in a way that was ever intended, but that's exactly what happened there. And of course, it's also reminiscent of Eliezer Yudkowsky's Moore's Law for Mad Scientists, wherein we're approaching this singularity of empowered evil people, if you want to look at him as evil. I don't really want to get into a debate about whether he's a good guy or a bad guy. The point is, this guy acted illegally for sure, and was able to pull off something that wouldn't even have been possible in an earlier era, right? Because you would never have been able to stuff that many file folders into your truck on the way out. You know what I mean? It's just there was no way to do this before technology made it possible. Before technology made it possible, shouldn't have happened anyway, but made it possible for one person to get their hands, figuratively speaking, on all that information and to move that information to a place where it was never intended to go. And that says a lot about both the kind of security that government systems, government agencies, and businesses are going to need to have in place in the future. It also says a lot, as we're learning, about what the government's been up to, which is not terribly encouraging when we learn that, for example, the government essentially accessed all the metadata on all the phone records in the country. They were not listening into our conversations necessarily, but they were accessing information that, as soon as a federal judge looked at it, ruled, nah, they didn't have any right to be doing this. And more embarrassing things have come out along the line. And according to who is it that's publishing this? Is it The Guardian? I can't remember now off the top of my head. The Telegraph, one of the British publications, is actually slowly but surely filling the world in on this. The U.S. government was helping itself to the emails and phone messages of other world leaders. So, yes. You know, what's interesting about that is not necessarily that it's all that shocking, right? You know, even our allies, right? We're listening in on their phone conversations or their voicemail, or we've tapped into their email. It's not all that shocking, but it's the sort of thing that should never, ever be revealed, right? It's because it's diplomatically so awkward, and it speaks to, wow, what else is in there, and are there things in there that when they come to light are going to be more than awkward, right? Are there things that are in there that when they come to light are going to be potentially extremely dangerous in terms of what they might do to international relations? So it's a really telling story about our times, and a really, I think, telling story about the era that we're moving into, one where government has found a way to become more intrusive and just has naturally become so, and a world where individuals can really take on an awful lot of power. Government can take on a lot of power. Individuals can take on an awful lot of power. And none of it makes me sleep any better at night, I got to tell you. There's nothing in this story that makes me feel particularly good. How about you, Stephen?
No, not at all. We're hearing from one federal judge, and it'll end up at the Supreme Court before it's all said and done, that more than likely the NSA was just rampantly running over the Constitution. It was, obviously it's up to the court to ultimately make that decision, but it's looking that way. And what's interesting, there's also, what's going to happen to Snowden? I mean, he's got temporary asylum in Russia right now.
Right.
But he's apparently, the latest thing I've heard is that he's looking to Brazil. Brazil wants to use some of this information to basically press their interests. You're spying
right.
on us, and, how dare you? And they want to – and basically Snowden is attempting to negotiate, some of this information with Brazil for permanent asylum in that country. He's in a kind of a dangerous situation, I would think. I consider our country the good guys, but I think he's got a big target on him.
You want to talk about the good guy?
It would not surprise me to wake up and read that he had an accident.
Had some terrible accident. Well, why he couldn't fly out of Moscow?
He knew that he'd end up with a bag over his head, probably.
No, it's because he was Snowden.
Oh man!
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay,
terrible.
That's the worst joke of the show. Okay, I think literally this year, probably. Yeah. It's gonna be very interesting to see in 2014 whether his circumstances change. Is he just gonna be in Russia from here on in? Is he gonna make his way to Brazil? What surprising new things do you? They say they haven't even touched the tip of the iceberg. Can that be true? Is there a lot more shocking stuff that we're going to learn? I think there must be. This is a story that has only really started. There's a lot more to be learned, and I think interestingly and kind of frighteningly, we're going to just see a lot more of these kinds of things moving into 2014 and beyond. Hopefully, we'll learn from this. Businesses and the government will improve. There's obviously a need for transparency. There's a need for real respect for privacy, and real respect for the rule of law where the Constitution is concerned, and also a need for vital, secure information not to be able to be just hijacked and taken out of the organization and moved elsewhere. So we'll see if those lessons are internalized and what happens next. Should be some interesting times ahead. Okay. Oh, we've got a few more minutes, and I've still got some big ones. Now, here's one from the world of science, and we did talk about this when it broke. This would have been back in March or April, I think, but it was simulations back up the theory that the universe is a hologram. Basically, this is some fairly out there kind of research in physics, but what it suggests, if what it's telling us is true, is pretty mind-blowing. It's one of the biggest discoveries ever if it turns out to actually be a discovery. Basically, going back a number of years, there was a physicist named Juan Maldacena who said that maybe the whole universe that we see is actually just kind of a holographic projection of the actual universe. And he gave, you know, that is a vast oversimplification of his theory. It was actually a, you know, mathematical physics theory, and it has some interesting things going for it. It explains certain things if that's the case, but it didn't have an awful lot backing it up. Well, what happened this year is that some scientists found a way to make string theory and regular, what do I want to call it, just like the standard model, non-string theory view of the universe, work together, okay? So you could make the 10-dimensional string theory universe and the 4-dimensional space-time universe that that we know kind of from more classical physics. You can actually make those two models talk to each other. You can make them work if you set them up in this relationship, wherein the string theory 10-dimensional universe is the holographic projection, and the 4-dimensional universe is the thing making it. I might have that backwards. Come to think of it, I think I probably do.
But the fact that the two models work together, if you take this into account, that's you got that correct. And I would just say that, Phil, if that would be a remarkable coincidence if it turns out that the hologram theory is not true.
That's
right.
It'd
be a remarkable coincidence that those two models work together.
Or somebody just fudged the numbers to make them work, you know, is the other
possibility. Yeah, that's true. That sort of thing happens. But it's, it is in papers that have been publicly, vetted and had some other guys go behind it and check it out. So, yeah, it's
so far, so good. So far, it looks
so
like
so far, so
it
good. Put
like
it that way, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and if true, okay, wow, the universe we're living in is actually this holographic projection from this actual real universe, and that's kind of freaky, okay? You know, that's one of those things where you just have to sit back and kind of contemplate it for a while, because you start thinking about, okay, well, all the experiences, for example, that I'm having, they're occurring here or they're occurring there, and where is here? Right? Am I really in, you know, is this really this, or is this just fake and I'm actually down there in the strings, right? And that's the real me, that's the real world down there, and this world is just this odd projection, illusion, if you will. So the philosophical implications, I think, are profound. It also speaks in an interesting way to an idea that we've talked about quite a bit on this program, which is the simulation hypothesis. Because if, in fact, we are living not in a purely natural universe, but in a universe that was created, a universe that is a simulation of the real universe, then this is maybe the sort of thing that you would expect, that as with a computer interface where there's some real processing going on at one level, and then there's sort of a projection of the whole thing at another level. There's various levels of interface, various levels of substrate. We see that same kind of thing being replicated in the natural world, in the universe itself. It doesn't prove that the universe is a simulation, but it is compatible with it in the same way that the compatibility between these two things suggests that maybe the holographic projection idea is actually what's going on. So it's not the breakthrough. We haven't learned for sure that we live in a simulation or even that the universe is a projection. But now we've got some evidence that we didn't have before pointing us in that direction, and it raises some very interesting questions about how much we really know about how things work and how much we're likely to learn in the years to come.
I think the philosophical aspect is what you were talking about is interesting, Phil. It's I think there's you can come back to saying, well, you know, it's the Descartes way of looking at world is what will win out because I think therefore I am the experiences I have. are real because they are my experiences. It might be that the universe operates in a much simpler way than it would appear just looking out upon it, but it doesn't make our experiences any less real. I think philosophers may come down that way, but at any rate, it's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, and like with quantum theory, which has all these weird-sounding implications, but the world works exactly the way it's always worked, even whether you know quantum mechanics or not. It's exactly like that in the end, right? Well, here we are. Okay, if I'm really here, or if I'm being projected here, as you said, the experience is identical. In some ways I'm no better off for knowing that, and no worse off for knowing it, except, well, maybe I've got a new thing to think about.
It's good for a blown mind on some rainy afternoon.
I guess we've solved the philosophical problem. Yeah, other than the blown mind, it really has no impact. But in as much as it speaks to the universe being structured very differently than we thought, and in a way that is compatible with a really weird universe, a universe that isn't just this naturally occurring entity that we want it to be, that's pretty intriguing. So,
and of course, the better we understand the universe, the closer we are to what we really want, which is warp drive, right? So, you know,
there you
more
go.
Power to you guys.
Exactly.
Figure it out for us.
Well,
figure
the thing is, you know, if we can figure out how to make things happen down there in the strings, right? We can do anything we want to up here in the projection. We just got to learn how to, hack the strings. Okay, I've got one left. Did you have any others, Stephen? We got about four minutes.
No, we can certainly take the 9 minutes left of the show on talking about this. So go for it, Phil.
Okay, so my last one, and by the way, this is hardly a definitive list. We could easily have done a two-hour show on this, or a two-parter, or something like that, because there's been a lot of big stuff that's happened in the years. We haven't talked about Amazon's drones, right? Which is definitely a big move toward the future. We haven't talked about Google acquiring a robotics company. Interesting move to the future. But this is one that occurred this year, and it's real, and that is the release of Google Glass. Happened about the middle part of this year. And this is the beginning, really, of the age of wearable computing meets augmented reality, right? With Google Glass, essentially you're walking around looking at the world through your computer interface. It's a completely new experience, fundamentally different from anything that's existed before, something that we only had analogies to from the movies with things like RoboCop and Terminator, where those characters, you know, had a display overlaid on their actual visual display. What they were seeing had information laid over on it, and now Google Glass provides that same capability. So it's this ability to, in effect, put yourself inside the computer and be in the computer as you're interacting with the real world. It's a huge paradigm shift for computing. Even as ubiquitous as devices have become, as reliant as we are on mobile devices and computer technology, this is a big, big shift. And we'll see how well it's going to work out. I haven't heard that Google Glass is exactly tearing the world up. So, it's the first step in this direction. But the world is going to be different from now on because of this, isn't it?
I agree, and Google Glass may be not be the device that does it. It's just the harbinger, you know. I think in some ways, you know, potential app developers are kind of at a loss as to, you know, what do we do with this? We're talking the first iteration of a new technology. It's going to get better, it's just so early, we really don't know. But I will make this prediction. I believe I've said this before on the show, Phil, that this is the technology, computer overlay over your vision, is the way we're going to wear our computers. We're not, you know, wearable computers are not going to be wristwatches. I'm just going to go out there and put that prediction out there. A wristwatch just doesn't have a big enough display. Google Glass fills up your visual field. Interacting with a watch, you know, if you've got a touch screen, it's just not a very big touch screen. The world is your touch screen with Google Glass, our devices that will come after. And so, that's the way it's going to be. And, eventually you'll see things like this disappearing into contact lenses and then maybe permanent surgery, where this sort of device is just always with you.
The difference is between those two, and I'm not sure that it's really a race between those two things, although that is the other thing that's been presented as kind of the future of mobile computing.
Yeah.
And as you pointed out, it's really kind of a dead end because it's got that small, smaller screen, and it's stuck to your wrist. You know, it's not like a phone which you can move around and do what you need to with it. Right?
At least you can use both hands on your phone. You know, you can't do that with a wristwatch.
The difference being, in the short term, wearing a wristwatch is a perfectly normal thing to do. Having a device on your wrist is not weird. Walking around with glasses that have like little electric. Special electronic stuff is still weird, right? I mean, that's the difference between the two.
I suspect it will always be weird, Phil, because when ultimately this is adopted, it'll look like these things will look like normal glasses,
right?
And you won't be able to tell that whether someone's wearing good old fashioned glasses or if it's Google Glass version 10 or eyeglasses, Apple's eyeglasses, version 3. It's going, you get a couple generations into this, and you won't be able to tell that it's a wearable computer anymore. So
Ken in the chat room says that augmented reality is the beginning of the end of the world as we know it. And my response to that, of course, is I feel fine. Right, but
my response to that is, we're always ending the world as we know it. So
yeah,
don't be scared.
But I agree. It's that big. It's a big
yeah.
change.
I agree too.
Once we're carrying the interface around with us like that, it is going to be a completely different world.
That's right. That's right. I used to kid that Google is part of my brain. Back when it was just on my desktop computer. Now, of course, it's in my pocket, and it's less of a joke. It'll be even less of a joke when it's in my visual field.
When it's literally standing between you and the rest of the world. Yeah, that's the.
That's right, and I can talk to it, and it talks back to me, At what point is
and
it?
And you just won't be so lonely anymore, Stephen. Let's face it.
That's right. You know, it's a poor lonely guy. Now I've got Jarvis with me at all times.
So we'll see. We'll see what happens in 2014. New version of glass. New technologies that come along that maybe threaten glass. One thing's for sure. I think you're right, Stephen. That augmented reality is the future, and I think through visual display is how we're ultimately going to see it happen. Well, with that, we are out of time and out of our list. We will say that we'll be back next year with we're going to be doing more of the video shows for sure. We're going to be back on weekly for sure, and we're going to be getting a lot more into these developments and tracking them as they occur. Looking forward to being with you all in 2014. What's our music this evening, Stephen?
We're going to go to the past and pull out one that I just love so much. It seems appropriate here at the end of the year. A Glorious Dawn. This is Carl Sagan. You'll hear a little Hawking in there, and a little John Boswell. We love this song, so I thought it'd be appropriate to play it at this time of year.
Absolutely. Let's let Carl and Stephen take us home for 2013. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Thank you all for being with us. Happy holidays to you all and a happy new year. We'll see you in 2014. And until next time, live to see it.
I'm not very good at singing songs, but here's a try. Scratch. You must first invent the universe.
network of wormholes. You might emerge somewhere else in space. Some went out in time.
The sky calls to us. We do not destroy ourselves. We will one day venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits. Not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. Or the rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of exquisite interrelationships of the awesome machinery of nature.
I believe our future depends powerfully on how well we understand this cosmos, in which we float like a mote of dust in the morning sky.
And the brain does much more than just recollect. It intercompares, synthesizes, analyzes, it generates abstractions.
The simplest thought, like the concept of the number one, has an elaborate logical underpinning. The brain has its own language for testing the structure and consistency of the world. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns, or the rising of the Milky Way. The sky calls to us. We do not destroy ourselves. We will one day venture to the stars.
For thousands of years, people have wondered about the universe. Did it stretch out forever, or was there a limit? From the Big Bang to black holes, from dark matter to a possible Big Crunch, a ravage of the universe today is full of strange-sounding ideas.
How lucky we are to live in this time, the first moment in human history when we are, in fact, visiting other worlds. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way.
A still more glorious dawn awaits. Not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way.
The surface of the Earth is the shore of the cosmic ocean. Recently we've waded a little way up.